Hey, well, thanks, Tony. I warned Tony when he asked me to give this talk that there would be no physics in it, and it would be questionable whether there'd be much of any science in it, but at least it might be somewhat amusing. Okay, so I'm talking about fractal landscapes, and to the extent there is any science in it, I give thanks to Tom Dunn, who used to be at the University of Washington, which is now here, and Dave Montgomery, both geomorphologists, who steered me to some of the literature and so on, but they're not responsible for any mistakes I may have made in interpreting the literature. Now, I'm going to be showing you a computer program called TerraForms, which is the current incarnation of what I've done. It all started out as a hobby back in the sort of mid to late 1980s, playing around with my Amiga computer, if any of you remember, Amiga computers, which had, for the time, relatively good graphics. And but then I started getting, read some of these books. Of course, Mandelbrot, Fractional Geometry of Nature. And then in terms of more hands, you know, more talking about specific algorithms, The Science of Fractal Images, which is a collection of articles, including ones by Mandelbrot and Voss on fractal landscapes. Now, in this second book, The Science of Fractal Images, Mandelbrot in his appendix, in his section, talked about algorithms for fractal landscapes and said that an outstanding problem was finding a way of incorporating random river networks into fractal landscapes in a in a plausible way. What people had done up to then was pretty artificial. They had sort of geometrically regular, maybe complicated, but very geometrically regular and sort of imposed patterns without any real random, not very realistic. Now, if those of you who are interested in the science of this, there's a recent book by Rodriguez, Iturbe, and Rinaldo called Fractal River Basins, which goes into, it's a thick book which talks about both real river basins and how they can be modeled by fractal algorithms. So I recommend that to it's they do a lot of modeling. I must say, I think, by and large, my landscapes look nicer than theirs, even if they're not scientifically quite as rigorous. Okay, so I'm going to be talking a little bit about some general properties of fractals that are relevant to fractal landscapes, and then about some of the algorithms, and a little bit about, whether these fractal landscapes, where real landscapes are fractal, in what sense, and how one might try to analyze that. And then a little bit about some post-processing erosion modeling that's incorporated into my program, and then show you the program. So, okay, so I'll need that later. Okay, well, one of the simplest fractals, which is in all the standard books, is called the Venkatsch curve. And you start with a straight line like this up here, and then you displace it by dividing the line into three segments and then bowing one segment out as an equilateral triangle. So this angle here is 30 degrees. And then, so you wiggle the river, wiggle the line out and back like that. And now you do that recursively. You take each segment of this and add a triangle in the middle, and you get this curve. And when you keep doing that, you get a curve which gets more and more convoluted and is a fractal and has its length becomes infinite, even though the total distance from beginning to end is constant, and the straight line distance from beginning to end is constant. The length following the curve is infinite, the limit of infinite subdivision. And it is a fractal in the sense that there's a scaling property of its length as a function of how finely it's subdivided. In other words, if you let the segment length be at the nth level be R sub n, then at the next level, the segment length decreases by a factor of 3 because you're taking, you know, a line and dividing it into 3 pieces, but then you're adding this bow. So the length then is of the number of segments increases by a factor of 4 as you go to the next level. Now that means that the length of the river, which in fractal language is you write as 1 over the subdivision scale times an exponent, which is the fractal dimension minus 1. Now 1 over r goes as 3 to the n because we're, you know, r is decreasing by a factor of 3 at each stage. But then the length of the river is the number of segments times r. And so the length of the river increases by a factor of 4/3 each time you subdivide. And that means that L over L naught is 4/3 to the n, and that gives log d, a d, fractal dimension of log 4 over log 3, which is about 1.26. Now, in the current version of my program, the rivers, in a sense, are actually, in a certain sense, are like Van Koch curves. I mean, they are constructed in a rather similar way, except that the path of the river is not going sharply out along the equatorial triangle, but is this red dashed line going between the tips of the triangles. But again, it has the same fractal dimension in the idealization that you just, you know, add things and you don't have reconnecting, you know, you don't cut off any meanders or wiggles of the rivers, and you just keep building up. Of course, my rivers, this construction, you're always wiggling to the same side, always to the left here, going up, always wiggling in the same direction. But in my rivers, the wiggling is a strong random component to it, though it can be biased by if you want to. And so the wiggles are sometimes one way to the left and sometimes to the right. Okay, now the we're talking about surfaces, then sort of an ideal fractal, which is if you have a 2D height field, Z of X and Y, you can represent it as some Fourier spectrum, and in this way, so the RMS fluctuation in Z, the mean square fluctuation goes as an integral over the power spectrum, which I did, you know, if you normalize it to per unit log k, then this power spectrum, if you assume this power spectrum is a power law in wave number k to the minus 2h, then you get a fractal. And you see that if h greater than 0, this integral for dz squared converges as k goes to infinity and blows up as k goes to 0. So on large scales, small scales, it blows up at small scales and is finite on large scales where k goes to 0. Now, so you can construct a fractional Brownian surface then by considering this kind of a power spectrum with random phases and constructing a surface. Now, if you consider the variance, which is the RMS difference in height between two points separated by some fixed distance c, where you do an average keeping c constant, then it's easy to see that this variance is constant, is finite for 0 less than h less than 1, and is proportional to the power, RMS variance, to the power c to the power h, assuming this power law spectrum. All right. Now the variance blows up as k goes to infinity on small scales if h is less than or equal to 0, or h is greater than or equal to 1, it blows up if k goes to 0. But for h between 0 and 1, it's finite for some given c. So what one has then is that the variance divided by c, which is sort of a measure sort of an average slope, becomes infinite as c goes to 0 and smooth as large scale, so this goes to ratio goes to 0 as c goes to infinity. Now this surface is, technically speaking, not a self-similar fractal like the von Koch curve in that the self-similar fractal really looks the same as you blow it up in a microscope looking at smaller scales. But the point is the surface locally gets steeper and steeper as you look in smaller scales with this kind of a fractal. So this is what's called a self-affine fractal, and that if you, to get this similarity, you have to scale the horizontal distances and the vertical distances by different factors. But within the scaling, the surface is statistically the same on all scales. So this is an ideal fractal, and I won't say very much about how one measures this. There are box counting algorithms and so on, but in this is the time, we'll skip that. And because of, I'll come back to it a little bit later, perhaps. Now, what about fractal landscapes? Okay, well, there are various methods discussed in this, particularly in this book, Science of Fractal Images. You can use spectral methods where you try to approximate fraction Brownian motion. You can use fast Fourier transforms, which have a discreteness, a substantial discreteness in wave number. So on large scales, small wave numbers, it's not a good approximation to a smooth power spectrum. Or Mandelbrot talks about independent random cuts. You can use a sample the Fourier spectrum uniformly in log k in some way, or you can use what are called band-limited noise functions. Now, there is an option in my program to use this option 4 to get something which in which you have a noise function which, on a given scale, has a certain characteristic wavelength, but is not periodic. It's random, but with sort of a Fourier spectrum which is peaked around a certain range of wavelengths. And you superimpose these with smaller scales to get a random surface which in which there are then correlations between the fluctuations at different points on the surface, because this noise function has correlations. And this is my way to try to approximate fractional Brownian motion, is method 4. Now, the problem with this, in talking about real landscapes which have rivers and river valleys and so on, is that to get all these fluctuations to the spectral method to sort of be in phase, the right phase at the river, so that you don't start raising hills in the middle of the river, it requires phase coherence, and that's rather difficult to impose. Now I have a way of doing that, forcing that, but my basic scheme is more like this point displacement methods, where you give random fluctuations to individual points in the landscape. You have a lattice of points, and the at least sort of the first order, the fluctuations are independent. Random fluctuations are independent at each point, though there may be but the fluctuations are about some average z, and the main thing then is how you determine this reference height for the fluctuations. Now, one of the oldest versions of fractal landscapes, which this was used in one of the Star Trek movies to create a new world in the movie, is to have new points at the midpoints of the you know, halfway between the old points, so you end up one triangle going into four triangles. Now, this is, Mandelbrot has criticized this method because it tends to produce creases, because you see the, you know, the this fluctuation is about an average of these two points, and it's clearly independent of what the heights are away from, say, this line. So you tend to develop sort of creases in the landscape.
Are you talking about fractal mountains or fractal rivers?
Well, both. I mean, here I'm talking about not so much about the rivers, but just about the mountains and so on. So
the basic confusion, which is I thought the surface of the river should be level.
Well, I mean, the landscape, the river is in a landscape. The landscape has fluctuations, but then the river is constrained to have a smooth slope, downward slope.
So I'll
come to that in a minute. And now the method I've used in my program is called centered tile midpoint displacement, where you instead add points at the middles of the triangles rather than along the edges. And you start off then, when I start off constructing a fractal landscape, I start off with the six points, well, the points at the vertices of these six triangles, which is a total of seven points, actually. So you have points here, and then you add new points at the middles of the triangles, and also you sort of expand the at the edges. And at least you start, the basic algorithm is you take an average of the heights of the three points at the vertices of the triangle, and use that as a reference, and then add a random fluctuation about that height for the point at the center of the triangle. And and then when you do this, you get then a more refined lattice. The edge length decreases by a factor 1 over square root of 3, and the new triangles are oriented at 45 at 60 degrees relative to the old triangles, or 90 degrees, depending how you count. But so you get this new lattice represented by the black lines, and you can see that the now this brings in the points outside the original triangle. So the information, sort of the height information, sort of does tend to diffuse a bit. Rather than just being confined locally. And, okay, now...
Jim, I presume you're going to show us that later, but the human mind brain can distinguish between these different ways of doing the landscape. The landscape would look...
Yeah, the particular algorithm does influence how the landscape looks.
And we are good enough to tell right away.
Yeah, well, you can usually at least tell that it's different, from one looking at one algorithm versus another. Okay, so we'll take this. Now, what about rivers? Well, now rivers flow along triangle edges, and let's see, this lined up right. So let's say, and the basic idea then is, before you start subdividing, you add springs at points in the landscape. Now, a spring can be located where there's one of the six directions from a vertex is downhill.
By spring, you mean source of water.
So that's the source of a river, and then you extend that river as far as you have a monotonic downward slope. Now, if you hit the bottom of a depression, the river will end, or if you run off the edge of the landscape, the river will end. So let's say we have a river now, and we're going to subdivide once more. So we're going to add points at the centers of the triangles. These triangles produce a new lattice. All right, now, the point is, before you actually start, the first thing you do is figure out how the river is going to go. Because you see, when you start connecting these new triangles, the triangle edges are no longer along these triangle edges. So the river is forced to,
But I'm not sure what happens if you have a local maximum, a local minimum.
A local maximum, you could have more than one river, because there might be, there's a particular algorithm involving, the river has to have a channel in the sense that that the if the point it's going to is lower than either of the two adjacent directions.
But you have some rules on how it plays.
So there are certain rules then on how to. So the river then has to. We have to wiggle the river because, you know, the river, well, you still have these points, you know, are still in the landscape. The river will now have to flow along either along this way or along this way in the new, at the next level. And here it will have to flow this way or this way and so on. So now depending on how that happens, let's say, now that's basically sort of a random process. You know, decide which way by a random process. Now, one possibility is to let that just be a 50-50, you know, which side it wiggles. But another possibility is to bias the wiggling depending on whether the original river has a bend in it or not. So, so whereas the river is straight, like it is here, the point downstream from this point, which is in the middle of a straight section, it's 50-50. But at a point here, you can bias things so that the river is more likely to go to the outside of the bend than the inside of the bend. Now that affects the practical properties of the river because you can see that here, if say the river wiggled this way here, now if it were to wiggle this way here, you'd get the path of steepest descent would no longer be through this point. It would just go straight like this, and it would cut off that meander, in a sense. And so that's what happens here in this hypothetical case. But here, you know, the river wiggles to the right here and to the left here, and it's not, you know, cut off. So here you're sort of building up a meander. Here you're cutting one off. And if you bias the river strongly to the big going to the outside of the curve, you minimize this cutting off of meanders, and you tend to get a more wiggly river course. But if it's just random, then a lot of the time you are cutting off meanders, and the river ends up, on average, relatively straight. Okay. Now, the important thing now is that the rivers. Is now that when you add points at once you've determined the course of the river, should have kept this here. Once you've determined the course of a river, now you start. And in doing so, you then ensure that the heights along the river maintain a monotonic downward slope. But now you start adding, now you go and you're going to determine the heights of the points in the middle of the triangles, which are not on a river. And the point is, for the points next to a river, there's a constraint that you want to constrain the height, new height of this point, so that it's not lower than the point downstream from any adjacent river point. So here you're saying that you have this point is adjacent, this point is adjacent, so you want it not to be lower than this point, right? Because otherwise, if you were to rerun the river from the spring, the river would end up going here, and it might end up being a local depression. So you constrain the fractal process, the fluctuations near the river, so the rivers maintain the course that was determined by this random meandering. And that tends to then form sort of a natural sort of valley around the river as you carry out this fractal process and so divide more and more. And for points that are not adjacent to rivers, there's no constraint particularly. Now there's a lot of sort of variations on this, which I've incorporated in my program, various sort of gimmicks. Well, the basic sort of fractal dimension is determined by what I call the fractal index, which is just the factor by which the amplitude of the height fluctuations decrease at each stage of subdivision. There's a relief bias. You can enhance the fluctuations at high elevations and suppress them at low elevations to get jagged mountains and smooth valleys. you can have a vertical offset, which you can say you take this average height of the neighboring points, and then you can say that the fluctuations are really not about that height, but by a height offset above or below that average. And that can tend to then sort of make the landscape sort of rise, if it's positive, this vertical offset is positive, tend to rise where it's not pinned down by a river. And that tends to produce sort of a more V-shaped river valley. While if you, on the other hand, if you bias the height downward, that tends to produce, you know, broad, relatively flat river valleys. Then there's an option to make the amplitude of the fluctuations depend on the steepness of the landscape in the vicinity of where you're adding the point. A very important thing is the spring probability. In other words, where do you put, you know, you have any place where there's a downward slope going away from a point is a place where you can add a spring. But you may or may not want to add springs that densely as to put them everywhere possible. And so you can vary the spring probability to give a different densities to the river network. There's a meander slope, which has to do with this outward bias of the meandering to be to the outside of a curve. That is that is strongly in effect when the slope of the river is less than this meander slope, which is a parameter you can specify, and becomes more random, 50-50, as you go to slopes which are steep compared to this meander slope. You can also put in a bias to the river meandering so it tends to avoid steep terrain on one side, where the terrain on one side rises much more steeply than on the other side of the river. You can tend to say the river is going to tend to wiggle away from the steep terrain and thereby avoiding sort of a river sort of cutting into a cliff strongly, or you can do the reverse if you want strong big cliffs. You can put big springs more or less likely on valleys versus ridges, and you can also have the points adjacent to the river. You can suppress the fluctuations near the river based on how far you are in the river from its source. And so far downstream, whether you say you have, you know, a major river valley, you can tend to suppress the fluctuations more strongly than you do to a little gully coming down the side of a mountain. So that tends to produce wider river valleys. And then the river DZ factor is the maximum factor by which you can suppress the height fluctuations. You can also lower the riverbed by, which, according to this erosion scale, you can say when you add one of these intermediate points, you can say the height of that point is going to be, if the erosion scale is strongly in effect, it's going to be close to the height of the downstream old point. And then afterwards, you adjust the heights of the old points to sort of maintain a fairly uniform slope to the river. You can lower points which are surrounded by points which are, you know, say, a very steep pinnacle. You can try to, this controlled by this slump scale. And the height fluctuations, you can have either Gaussian, there are certain different probability distributions. You have Gaussian fluctuations, which is the default uniform probability distribution, or it can use these noise functions to generate the fluctuations.
Jim, the natural question here would be that with so many parameters to adjust, whether you can do the inverse bump, can you reproduce any real landscape?
Well, that's the idea, is to have enough freedom to produce a variety of different kinds of landscapes, so you aren't restricted to just one.
Is it possible to produce real landscapes? If I give you a picture?
You can get, I'll show you some pictures, so you can decide for yourself, but yeah, you can produce some fairly nice looking, you know, realistic looking landscapes this way. All right, now, I might just say there's, you know, another option, which is after, or maybe during the fractal process, but not as part of the fractal process, you can incise the rivers according to a law which is this sort of area slope kind of law, where you say that the rate of lowering of the river is proportional to some power of the area, drainage area upstream from the river and the slope of the river. And this gives sort of an advection-like equation for how the height of the river evolves. And this combination here is sort of the effect of velocity. In other words, so the river profile then, under this kind of law, tends to then migrate upstream. and sort of a wave propagating upstream. And depending on whether this advection is roughly constant or, you know, how it varies with position along the river can say whether the river bed tends to develop a nick point, in other words, a sharp sort of be flat and then sharply go down, or whether it tends to smooth out, or whether you just have sort of a uniform propagation upstream. So again, this is something you can just play around with and try different things out.
And the empirical values for fitting the
river. Okay, they
that's for real rivers.
Well, for real rivers, the claim, there's actually not a great deal of agreement in the literature. And there's a paper by Howard et al. Which talks about a number of different models which give quite discrepant results. But he says that the empirical evidence is that for this exponent, A, something in the range of 0.25 to 5, and B, around 0.7 is supposed to be the roughly. Now, what that does, B less than 1 means that this velocity then is larger where the slope is smaller for a given drainage area. And that tends to mean that, say, if you have a down bend like this, it means the upstream part tends to erode, where it's flatter, tends to erode faster, and the downstream part, where it's steeper, tends to erode more slowly relative to its uniform wave propagating upstream. So that tends to smooth out the river. Now, to decide whether real landscapes have practical properties, there are various ways of trying to analyze this. I just might briefly make a point about this, that one standard way is to talk about the variance or a variogram, where you plot as a function of a lag L the RMS height difference between two points separated by this lag. And you can take different moments of this, and the standard variogram is where you take P equal 2, so it's an RMS height difference. Now, the problem is that this is really a poor measure of how the fluctuation power varies with scale. As you can see from the fact that, let's say you have a mountainside which is very smooth, right? It's steep, but it's very smooth. Now, you'll have then height differences down the slope, which are large, even for small L, or even though the slope is really perfectly smooth. So a better measure of the scale dependence of the landscape is this sort of roughness variables, where you take the difference of two slopes of points, you take three points in a line, say, each separated by a distance L, and then take the RMS difference of the two slopes from one segment to the next. And so that divided by L is sort of what I call roughness, and something which then tells you where this is large, it means you have a lot of power. And this is something, if you also, when you evaluate these heights, you take an average over a region which is, you know, say less than a half L, you also, that smooths out the high frequency power, and the finite range smooths out the low frequency or long wavelength power. So you get then something which is mainly sensitive to the fluctuations around some characteristic wavelength in the landscape. So I think this is a much better way of analyzing this. And I'll show you a little bit of some results from that. Now, you can also try to analyze river networks. This book by Rodriguez Turby goes into this in great detail, but there are various sort of topological measures which there's been a lot of attention paid to in the geomorphology literature, but the problem is they tend to give rather similar results for any network model you come up with, so they're not very discriminating. I don't have time to say much about it, but I have come up with a way of looking at the distribution of tributary drainage areas relative to the trunk drainage areas, which I think maybe is a better way of analyzing this. Okay, now, so I'll just maybe show some results quickly, since I don't want to have to switch back and forth between the computer and the overhead. This is taking a fractal landscape, which is constructed using this fractional Brownian motion algorithm. And this is something then which approximates and done in such a way that there are no rivers, it's just, you know, no constraints. So it should be close to something with uniform slope, and you can see it roughly is. At the largest and small scales, there's some deviations, but you know, that's due to the fact there is a discrete lower scale to the fractal landscape, and also in larger scales, you tend to get shot noise variation. So as this, and this is going between 0.1 and 1 for the roughness, so this is maximum in this particular case, maximum roughness is about 0.35. Okay, now, if we take a real river, or a real, rather not a river, but a real landscape, now, there is DEM data available. Now, this is from a relatively good DEM with 10-meter resolution. And again, this is a log scale on both axes, so going from 10 to 100 to 1,000 in meters for the point separation, starting at here, a little bit larger than that. You can see that this curve is not at all a straight line, which means I would, and there are papers in the literature which claim to find, you know, power law behavior for this kind of a statistic in landscapes, but I've never been able to do it. Any landscape I've looked at has this characteristic thing, which means it tends to be, relative to a power law, it tends to be smoother on small scales, and then there's some characteristic scale, you know, which is basically the scale of, you have some basic range of the landscape, and there's some characteristic valley spacing, you have valleys and ridges, typically have some characteristic spacing, and that gives you the maximum, and then it falls off in larger scales. And anyway, so that's, so I, as far as I'm concerned, I think there's not very much evidence for real landscapes being very fractal in the strict sense. Now, for the river length scaling, this is a case where this gets, this is, you can also ask about the fractal dimension of the rivers, and this is the case where there are just a few rivers in the landscape, and again, a fractal landscape using my algorithms. And you get here, the slope of this again relates to the fractal dimension, and here the fractal dimension is about 1.2, which is, and real rivers tend to have fractal dimensions around 1.1 to 1.2. So this is, and if you, when you start adding more complicated river network, the interactions between the tributaries and the main rivers tend to produce straighter rivers, and that then tends to decrease the slope. So the rivers in my fractal landscapes have, may not be precisely fractal, but at least the overall sort of fractal dimension is roughly the same as in rivers in real landscapes. And in this river incision, this is looking at the Tsang Po River in Tibet, at a place where it goes from about almost 3,000 meters down to less than 1,000 meters, and just, this is one of the most incredible gorges. The river goes between two very high mountains and falls by, you know, like 8,000 feet, which, you know, for a river is just incredible, in a relatively short distance. This is roughly the distance in kilometers. And so in this region here, it's just, and so we can play around with the erosion models for the Tsang Po River, and this is a case where the slope exponent is 1, which means that the characteristic velocity is, and the drainage area isn't varying too much along this part of the river, so this is not the whole river, it's just a small part of it. So what you basically get is this profile then just propagates smoothly upstream. So here, this is what the actual data gives, and then you get, and then your erosion modeling moves this really upstream, maintaining pretty much the same shape. Now, if you make the slope exponent greater than 1, which is not the direction that is claimed to be the, then you tend to develop this thick point. In other words, you see you get then this was a relatively smooth rollover, you get a fairly sharp nick point. where the river goes, where suddenly from being flat to being very steep as you erode. Now the fact that the river doesn't have the real river, it does not have a sharp neck point in ways then is an argument against this, because the river is incising very rapidly on geological, terms of geological timescales, and you'd expect it to develop a neck point if the erosion law was of that type. Okay, well, okay, so what I'd like to do now is show you the program, some of the results, and yeah. Okay, well, there's okay, this is an example of a fractal landscape, and I apologize, this looks much better on a computer screen, because the resolution here is 640 by 480, and it looks much better with higher resolution screen, and the colors on the projector are much darker than typically on a computer screen, so I had to try to do some last minute adjustments. The colors to get to look reasonable, but okay. So okay. So what I'm going to do now is show you a couple of different fractal landscapes, and I can read this. Okay, I'm gonna try to move this over. Okay, well, okay, so okay, so now we're going to show you what happens. Now, this is at what I call recursion level 1, whether on the order of 50 points or so. And you can see the triangle size is quite large now here. And so you have this relatively coarse river pattern. And now if we go to the next recursion level, now, as each increase in recursion level, the length of the triangle edge decreases by a factor of 3. The number of triangles increases by a factor of 9. So there's a big change. And if we can draw a picture of this, let's see, you can see it's very doesn't look too much like a real landscape. I'm going to raise the right here a little bit. Okay, now as we go up another recursion level, and maybe I'll move the point over a little bit. The camera over a little bit. Okay, now I'll draw the picture again. It's starting to look a little better. Now this is what's my default fractal parameters, which tend to produce fairly wide valleys at at the bottom, and have a fair amount of vertical exaggeration to produce sharp mountain peaks. And you can see that, and this is with a spring probability of 1. In other words, you're putting springs at the beginning of each increase in recursion level. You're putting springs every possible place. But then when you increase the resolution, then the spacing of the rivers becomes greater than the spacing of the triangles. But it's a very dense river network. And now we draw again. And And unfortunately, the screen resolution is starting to kill us here, but just for heck of it, I'll go up one more recursion level, which is not going to, the size of the triangles would be less than the size of the pixel over most of the, a lot of the pictures, so somewhat wasted, but. But you can see that this incredibly complicated network now of little creeks and rivers and gullies feeding into larger rivers, which you cannot really see, distinguish in this diagram from which are the large rivers and which are not. But when you draw a picture, now this level, the there are about 700,000 triangles in the landscape. And again, this is something where we got the screen resolution is just not enough to really do justice to it, but you get a rough idea. But you can see the meandering of the rivers you get. This lower part of this valley is relatively flat, and so the meandering tends to be more effective there, but in the higher parts of the rivers in the mountains tend to be straighter. Okay, now I'm going to start with now keeping the same fractal parameters and put in a new seed to show you the great variety you can get even with the same fractal parameters, just because of the difference in, you know, how things played out.
Minus what C is?
Oh, which?
Seed? It's a new seed?
Seed, yeah. Well, you seed the random number generator.
Oh,
so you get a new sequence of random numbers, giving you the meandering of the rivers and the fluctuations of the heights and so on. Okay, now, in the interest of time, I'll just just do this rather quickly. Well, maybe I will go. Okay, this is one where you have, begin with, you know, a more elaborate river network. In other words, you have just one sort of main sort of river drainage basin. In the previous case, you had several drainage basins making up the landscape. But here it's mainly just one big one. And the overall landscape is much flatter. And again, it's mainly the result of just, you know, what you started off with at the very lowest recursion levels is largely determines the overall character of the landscape. Of course, the details depend on what happens at higher levels. Okay, so, increase. And well, I'll draw this picture. So you can see now that, you know, the whole terrain is much flatter, and go up. This is, and now, if we draw the landscape, so this is the main river, and then you have these tributaries feeding in, and then little creeks which aren't really resolved. There's one here, for instance. Okay, now I'll show you. Now you can calculate the drainage areas. And this is color-coded, so the dark blue is where are points along the main river where you have a large upstream drainage area. Now, this lets you, you know, see the, and you can read off the drainage area by just clicking at any point on the river, and that tells you what the drainage area upstream from there is, or actually any point in the landscape. It doesn't matter whether there's a river there or not. definitely drainage areas for each vertex in the landscape. And while on the main river here, that was about 10,000. And here you have about 10 to the 8th, given the overall scaling, and it's somewhat arbitrary units. So that covers most of the entire patch. All right, so now, I'm going to show you next we'll go through a script which will show you what happens if now if we're going to create landscapes in which there's only just a few rivers in the landscape. That should have been a period instead of a comma there. Okay. I've created now a level one landscape which has sort of these two relatively long separate rivers. And this is a case where I've made the meander slope very large, so we're sort of giving a lot of meandering everywhere, regardless of how steep it is. And I'm going to move this observer here. Now, I'm rerunning the rivers between recursion levels, and that tends to straighten out things where there was, sometimes you end up, this is not 100%, but you can see that there's a lot of wiggling of the rivers even up in the higher parts of the terrain where it's colored brown and gray. That's rerunning. And this is drawing the picture of the landscape. Now here I've turned off the things which tend to flatten out the river valleys. And between between the rivers, you just have sort of random terrain. I mean, you don't have any very coherent drainage. There are a lot of lakes in if we could fill lakes, you see that because the more springs you have, the more it sort of keeps the drainage in place, but with these large areas between the rivers, you tend to develop depressions where they're, which end up as being, if you fill them with water, more or less, they become lakes. All right, so compared to the previous landscapes we've looked at where you had a high density of rivers, there were very few, rather small lakes. Okay. Now we'll keep going. I'm going to try it again now with putting the meander slope down to a small value of 0.01. So as we go up in recursion level, the rivers on the whole should be straighter, particularly as we at level 4. You still have some meandering, but it's not nearly as much as before. And this is also turning back on some of the things that tend to produce wider valleys. Now I'm turn the spring probability back up to 1 on all levels, and you can see that now that makes a big difference in the appearance of the landscape, because all the rivers tend to constrain the fluctuations and also sort of erode away the peaks, giving somewhat sharper peaks, but fewer of them, and you get an overall flatter landscape. Okay, well, that's the end of that. Now, I'm going to try maybe one more script, which shows this Sang Po area. You can import data for real landscapes into the program, and this works. So this shows, this is the Sang Po River here, which makes this funny, you know, almost 180 degree bend. And this peak here is almost 8,000 meters high. It's called Namji Barwa. And this one is still over 7,000 meters. And the river here is at about 3,000 meters, or less than 3,000 meters, and then falls to about 1,000 meters by the time you get there.
So this is a real landscape.
So this is a real landscape, but only at 1 kilometer resolution. In other words, the database only has points at a spacing of 1 kilometer, which is really pretty horrible resolution. And also what I've had to do here is, along these main rivers, is go in and smooth out the riverbeds by hand, because the data is so poor that, you know, particularly where the river goes through sort of a narrow place, there's sort of dams hundreds of meters high if you tried, you know, which would create just a huge lake filling up this whole upstream area, just from the poor resolution of the data and inaccuracies in the data. So where you see these blue lines is where I've gone in and smoothed out the beds to produce a monotonic downward slope.
You smoothed out by hand?
By hand, basically, you know. Sort of saying, well, interpolating between sort of the lowest points, could you figure that in the, you know, the river gorge, that, you know, typically the DM point will be higher than it should be, rather than, and not lower. So now we'll show up. Okay, now this is drawing the filling lakes and, oh wait, okay, so
this is the
real landscape, and in Tibet, and this is this Namji Barwa mountain, which according to the maps is about 7,756 meters. The highest point in the DM is about 7,300 meters, so it's not too well resolved. The upper part of the Sang Po, which is a huge, I mean, it drains a large part of the Tibetan plateau, so it has a huge drainage area. But it's very flat in this region. And then it's this region here where it drops down in this gorge between the mountains, which is, you know, thousands of meters deep. Okay, so we keep going. I can show you the result of this erosion modeling. And you see we're eroding down a narrow gorge because you have a huge drainage area right along the river compared to what it is off the river. So you get much stronger erosion right there. And there aren't any sort of, what really happens in Himalaya is you have the rivers incising, then you have landslides and sapping of this valley wall. So you widen the valley. Well, it's hard to compare. I mean, one thing is this resolution is just too poor to really show the real landscape. This is from the camera here is at about 10,000 meters. It's looking west, and has one more. Okay, so where there's more, still more erosion. And now the next camera position will be looking back the other way from to the west there. And so you can see, you know, the upper part of the gorge is starting to work its way down. So in the original landscape, this is all very flat in the part of the landscape, you know, in the foreground here. This is all very flat, and it's only here that you start getting into the gorge. Okay. Well, I think my time's up, so I'll stop here. I do have a few more things to show if people want to stick around, yeah. But I think we should let people in.
Well, people can have a choice between landscape and... Questions? Yeah.
Would you show the erosion pictures? What order of magnitude is the time scale?
Well, that depends on what the incision rate is. And for this particular area, I don't think it's not known. I mean, people haven't really studied. But there's a similar place on the other side of the Himalayas, near Nanga Parbat, where the Indus River also goes through a tremendously deep gorge with, you know, 8,000 meter peaks.
But is it centuries or years?
Well, it's like in the order of 100,000 years, maybe. That general order of magnitude.
How do they calculate?
Which is incredible. By ordinary standards, that's an incredibly fast incision rate. But it's just because you have such big rivers, you're flowing through such steep mountains, it's... it's
question here?
Yeah.
I think, what's the name? Doug Burbank has calculated some incision rates in that area in Nanga Parbat.
Yeah, right. There have been studies there. I think it's up to a centimeter a year or something, which may not sound like much, but geologically it's a very... very large.
Doug?
Yeah. Mother Nature has her own algorithm, since you're from Seattle, we appreciate that. I wonder if you've tried to, a lot of your algorithms have sort of a strong evolutionary hint in them, but I wonder if you've tried to take a fully evolutionary approach where you start with a flat landscape and rainstorms and just let it rip and see what happens.
Well, I played around with that to some extent. I was just forcing it to have a very smooth, you know, uniformly tilted plane to start with, and then putting in springs and doing this incision to erode things. Mm-hmm. And you get, you know, gullies and so on. I wouldn't say it's, there's really more, you know, as you have erosion processes in nature, it's more than just incision. You see also there's mass diffusion, sort of diffusive processes taking place. And there's maybe landslides if things get steep enough. And so it's more complicated than that. And there are, you know, I put in some of these features into the program, but I haven't really taken the time to play around with all the parameters well enough to really say whether I can get something realistic or not by adjusting things appropriately.
Yeah, maybe Mrs. Fabian can ask a question.
Well, what's the practical application of all this?
Well, fractal landscapes as such, I mean, are being used a great deal now in movies and commercials and so on. I mean, just look, you can see that they're obviously not real landscapes, but they, you know, have some sort of modeling to make them at least plausible.
Another question. And,
in what context? Well, okay, now the... You certainly can't just do it uniformly. And one thing is you can, what was done in these cases I showed you, is that the fluctuations are enhanced at higher elevations. And also the presence of the rivers does a lot to make things look more realistic. To have this these constraints, which do tend to quench the random fluctuations on them, certainly, and also perhaps near them, depending on the parameters.
Question?
One practical application of this is what makes with much longer something you have the movie maker. You think that the twinkling of starlight, and therefore at a given instant, you have a phase function, the function of position, say, on the thin screen in the upper atmosphere, or you're doing the medium or whatever. Now, the traditional way of doing it is you go to a sort of power spectrum, so we've got sort of Komodorovian spectrum or something like that, and just say it's a power spectrum, and it's randomly phased. Now, I think it's very clear that's not the whole story. Could you imagine going through a similar little set of algorithms to provide a much better and more faithful description of, in that particular example, the twinkling of starlight?
Conceivably. I mean, something worth thinking about.
Walter?
Fractals and laws of physics. Now, obviously, you use one law of physics here, and there's one that does not flow up.
Right.
But how do you get from the laws of physics as which presumably are responsible for the landscape of form, how do you get from this, by some kind of reasoning, to the conclusion that
well, first, I'm not convinced that real landscapes are very fractal, in spite of some claims in the literature. But it is you will have a variety of different processes acting, and people make model do make models in the geomorphological literature. Some of them are just very ad hoc. Some of them try to use some sort of physics of shear stresses at the bottom of flowing water and things like that. But my impression is that typically the models that try to incorporate the physics incorporate such a small part of the real physics that it's not clear that they really have that much relation to real landscapes. But people are trying to do that to some extent. I mean, one thing that I've done in my fractal landscapes is, I mean, rivers tend to try to flow straight in general, and that's what produces meanders, because they tend to eat away if they're as they get it develops over a random wiggle, then that wiggle tends to grow because of the way the river tries to flow straight, and that makes the bend sort of elongate in the downstream direction, and then you get sort of a developing meander. So that very qualitative idea is in the way I bias the meandering in my fractal rivers. But the fractal features, well, I don't think it's at all well understood. I mean, this book I mentioned called Fractal River Basins does try to make some arguments. I don't think there are very convincing reasons, and in very limited situations, there's maybe some sort, at least on say certain ranges of scales, there might be some arguments based on minimum energy principles or something that characterize, tend to give you a parallel scaling of things. And there's, so that's sort of trying to minimize the dissipation of energy, of the potential energy of the water as it flows downhill, and argue that from that you tend to develop certain kinds of networks, for instance. So there are some attempts, but I wouldn't characterize any of them as being terribly convincing, from my own point of view anyway, at present time.
Well,
Well, I guess some of the people that are interested in ethics in science are, have already left, but perhaps this is a good place to close so that the people interested in ethics should start walking towards the other lecture. Thank you again.
Now, if anybody wants to stick around and look at a few more, I do have some other cases.